Our sermon looks a bit different today, or at least our sermon time together. We hope that by sharing as a group, there will be something of value for everybody and that you'll be blessed just like we were. So Macy, Wes, Val, and myself, we are all excited to share about Thrive Leadership Conference 2025. And we took the requisite millennial picture by the sign that shows that we were there. So what is Thrive? That might be your first question. Thrive is a non-denominational leadership conference that happens every year in Roseville, California. So not too far away. It's at the Bayside Granite Bay Church campus. And we attended this year's session, and that began in May. So it was the beginning of May that we were there. And the conference itself exists to do a couple of things, but it's to inspire and equip church leaders, volunteers, and pastors to grow spiritually and practically. So there's a combination of keynote messages, breakout sessions, too many breakout sessions to attend, collaborative learning environments. All the attendees are challenged to sharpen their ministry tools and to deepen their personal faith. So some of the keynote speakers, the highlights for this year, included some of the following people. Some of these names might mean something to you, maybe they don't, but John Maxwell, well-known for leadership development and speaking. Bob Goff is a well-known Christian author. Carrie Newhoff, another voice prominent in modern Christianity. He actually had to cancel, so we didn't get the benefit of him. But a lot of fantastic speakers at this conference. And for us, the focus areas included spiritual formation, preaching and sharing your story, leadership development, evangelism, family ministry. That kind of covers the gamut of things that we learned about. And I'm going to pass it to Wes.
So maybe you're thinking, like, I'm not a leader of anything. That's kind of how I thought for myself. Why would I care about a leadership conference? Like, why would we go? I don't really have a ministry. But Jesus modeled leadership for us, and it's actually like serving others. Leadership, it's servantship. And we're called to a life of serving others. I mean, everyone here probably thinks that way, at least to some extent. You have a ministry. You just might not know what it is or think of it that way. John Maxwell, one of the people we listened to first, he talked about the outcome of leadership this way. The accurate measure of leadership is influence. It's nothing more and nothing less. Let's apply that to Jesus and consider the influence his servanthood and leadership had on the world. Matthew says this, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve," in Matthew 20, 28. To this day, we try to serve as he did in church. We wash each other's feet. We, as humans, we resonate with other servant leaders. I mean, our pastors. So if you serve anyone, if you have influence on anyone in your life, you are a leader.
We all attended the four general sessions, and then we each went to different breakout sessions. So between the four of us, we attended 16 different breakouts and learned a whole lot. This morning, we're each going to share our key takeaways with you. This doesn't have a neat narrative flow of a sermon. It's a bit of a patchwork. Think of it as a mosaic. Our prayer is that no matter where you are in your walk with Jesus or how you share God's love, you'll leave feeling encouraged and inspired. If you're a note taker, you'll probably want to write some of this down, or feel free to take out your phone and grab pictures of the slides where we'll highlight some of these ideas. We're going to begin by each sharing highlights of our individual trainings, and then we'll end by sharing some of the key takeaways from the general sessions. So with that said, we'll turn it over to Tim. Tim, what did you learn at Thrive?
What did I learn at Thrive? Not how to distill this all down into a nice, neat 10-minute package, that's for sure. I went to breakout sessions that focused on preaching and theology, developing pastoral skills, and building leadership cultures in the church. Now, some of you might see the list right now and go, I'm not a pastor, and feel comfortable just tuning out the next 5 minutes of whatever I say. But I want to, if you're tempted to do that, I want to challenge you with this, that we are all called to be ready to share our story, ready to share what Jesus has done in our lives. And the same thought and preparation that goes into crafting a message should be how we consider telling our story. It should have thought and attention to the things, calling out the ways in which God has really dialed into your life and shown you things. Whether it's in front of a group or one-on-one, this idea of compelling storytelling is a muscle that you can strengthen. It's not you have it or you don't. You can actually build that muscle. Now I'm going to give, again, I said at the start, a blanket disclaimer on behalf of our group. We cannot distill 4 one-hour sessions into a nice, neat little 10-minute package that gets you all this information. So you're getting highlights, not the whole enchilada or the whole burrito, for those of you who are also craving Mexican food today. Once upon a time, I actually don't have a follow-up for that, but something just happened in your brain. And those of you that may have disconnected for a second, you perked up for a half second when I said, once upon a time. And that's because our brains are wired for story and to respond to story. Since you were little, you have been trained to do something when somebody said, once upon a time. Look at the entertainment that we consume, the books, the movies, the TV shows, they're all about telling a story. The most compelling ones tell the most compelling stories. And this is how Jesus taught us. Whether you've consciously processed it or not, Jesus has given you a story to tell. It may not start with once upon a time, but he's given you a story, and it's powerful because you are the one that has lived it. And the best stories, I learned this, they don't just give people information, they provide transformation. This is how Jesus modeled it. He didn't just give us information to process. He provided us ideals through a story that transform how we live our lives. They change something. What people need is not just another idea to stick in their mental Rolodex. A new life is what they need. So when we tell stories, when we show how Jesus has transformed, that is the kind of storytelling that makes an impact. And here's the kicker. When you tell a story, Jesus is always the hero of the story, not you. It's important for us to both preach and speak to people's affections, not just their intellect. And I have a bad habit of doing this. I think that if I can craft a logical, compelling argument, I'll get people to agree with me and believe me. But here's the kicker. If you're anything like me, or if you're anything like the Apostle Paul, and we are at maybe opposite ends of the spectrum, you can resonate with this. I know what is right, but I don't do it. I know what is right, but I don't do it. Head knowledge does not equal right actions. And I love this book by James Smith. He talks about this idea that the most important thing in your audience is not what they think, but is what they feel. If that sounds off to you, if you're turning that around in your head and say, I don't know about that, I want you to consider Proverbs 4:23. And that says this, above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it. Feelings, what we feel, drives our actions. So when you tell a story or when you preach, you need to change what people want to do, not just what they know, what they want to do. You and I have brokenness. I feel comfortable saying that this morning. Everybody in here has brokenness. And if we believe the Bible, our brokenness is not an obstacle to be overcome. Our brokenness is our superpower. Take your brokenness and aim it at something. Show how the gospel intersects with the wounds that you have. People need to see you bleed and then see Christ heal that brokenness. If that wasn't challenging or uncomfortable enough, I was convicted of a few other key points during these breakouts, and Pastor Kenton, about a month ago, set this up very beautifully. He gave a sermon on the prodigal son and how the story wasn't just about the prodigal son, but the son who had continued to be at home. This idea that every message we give should speak to the older brother and to the younger brother. We need to reach the one inside the church and the one outside the church. The idea of apologetics, this defending and explaining the Christian faith, that should be part of our preaching, of our story. Because what I learned is that if you only focus on talking to Christians, all you'll ever get to talk to is Christians. The last key takeaway I wanted to share is about shaping a healthy church culture, both for leaders and volunteers, and maybe for those that are still finding their way. People enter these doors every week in different emotional climates. Maybe happy, sad, distraught. Something is weighing on them. And this is where humor and relatability and being able to share experiences, having a shared experience or life story, that becomes a powerful equalizer for the people that come into this place, this sacred place in different stages. And believe it or not, healthy culture does not just happen. Even in a church, healthy culture doesn't just happen. It takes intentionality, it takes commitment, it takes transparency about what's working and what isn't. And I did want to share here what I learned about what some of the hallmarks and aspirations of a healthy culture look like, and a few practical steps to get there. So, if you're a bullet point person, you will like this next section. In classic bullet point fashion, aim for excellence in process, not perfection in performance. Now, all the perfectionists in the room, don't feel attacked. I'm not coming after you. But it's more important for us to aim for excellence in our processes than in our performance. There's nothing wrong with that. I'd invite you to consider the example from the Old Testament, the directions that were given by God for constructing the tabernacle. This might be a section of the Bible that you sometimes just skip over because it's like 5 or 6 chapters where God lays out in detail how the tabernacle is to be constructed, from measurements to how you do it step by step, piecing together everything. There was intention that God gave in the process of constructing something important, and we can model that. Another thing I learned, if you want to stifle growth and volunteerism, have no or maybe as your default answer when faced with a new idea. What would it look like to start from yes and work backward? If somebody comes up with an idea of how we can adjust, how we can grow, how we can stretch ourselves in a way that God is calling us, what would it look like to start from yes and work backwards? And speaking of volunteers, and for those of you leading teams of people right now, be intentional in asking them, where can I let you lead? And a great rule of thumb that I learned here was that when somebody is 75% ready, let them lead. Let them lead. If we're waiting for people to be 100% ready to do things and to lead, we will always find reasons why they're not 100% ready. And remember, when you are training somebody or bringing somebody up, bringing a new volunteer along with you, you're not training them for you. You're training them for God and for them. This is the sacred part of discipleship and mentoring. This final quote that I really loved and appreciated, it can be appreciated by leaders and volunteers alike. Keep this at the front of your mind, and that is this. Giving clear expectations to a volunteer is the kindest thing you can do. How many of you have started to volunteer somewhere and had no idea what was really expected of you? Giving clear expectations to a volunteer is the kindest thing for them that you can do. That's a very whirlwind tour of some of what I came away with. And next up, I'm going to hand it to Val.
Thank you. I love that that last point on the 2 slides ago. Excellence in process, not perfection in performance. I need that on a fridge magnet or a t-shirt or something. I chose 4 breakout sessions that explored how discipleship and evangelism intersect in our real life relationships, especially our relationships to people who are in sensitive and diverse communities. We're all gonna say this. I learned so much about these topics that felt like drinking from a fire hose. And it was very overwhelming trying to think of what to use these few moments, you know, how to share with you all that I learned. But God kept impressing me to use this short time that I have to speak about a topic we really don't hear very much about, and that is outreach to the LGBTQ community. And sadly, there just isn't time to dive into the how. If you are interested in this, I'd love to connect with you, but there is time right now to talk about the why. Why we, as a church on mission, should care deeply about people within this community, not just from a distance, but in real life connection. And connection is important. Sharing Jesus is not some program I run. it's not a class I teach, it's not a small group, it's not prayer meeting, you know, it's not Sabbath school, although all those things are a part of it. But ultimately, discipleship is a life that I open up to others. That's what discipleship is, right? It's all about forming connection, like Wes said. The measure of our influence, or the influence, our influence is the measure of leadership. And to have any influence, we've got to be present and connected with people. Now, one thing I learned is that sexuality in general isn't just some abstract, like, out there topic. It is deeply personal and practical, and it deserves our acknowledgement. Reason number one is when we avoid talking about it, we miss out on opportunities to work through our big questions about it. We miss out on opportunities to share testimony about how God has healed and transformed us in this area, or maybe to identify that we're the one in need of healing and transformation, right? If we don't acknowledge sexuality as part of the human experience, the world is always going to have plenty to say, and not just the world, us in isolation, right? We're going to have our own ideas that might not be correct. So here's another reason we need to care deeply. Many people, especially young people, deconstruct their entire faith over LGBTQ issues alone. A 2024 survey by the Public Religion Research Institute found that nearly half of respondents, 47%, who left their faith cited negative ideas about the treatment of LGBTQ people as a reason. This was a particularly strong factor in younger Americans, with 60% of those under 30, 60% of those under 30, who left their faith pointing to the negative treatment of LGBTQ people. And I understand there's nuance in these questions and in these answers, but we still can't just toss that statistic away. 60% of young people who left their faith pointed to that as a primary reason. It's something we have got to address and have open dialogue about if we are going to develop missional leaders, especially, hear me on this, young missional leaders, to be equipped and empowered to serve, not just in church, but out there, in our culture, right? To meet people where they're at, inside and out of the church. The gay community and other communities that are essentially non-religious are historically an incredibly challenging place to reach with the gospel. So what? We are followers of Jesus, and he has called us to advance his kingdom by preaching the gospel without fear and inviting others into that kingdom. And in God's kingdom, no acceptable losses. No acceptable losses. I'm not an acceptable loss to God, neither are you. So I know I said I was not going to talk about the how. I lied. I cannot help it. This isn't nitty-gritty how-to. This is just, how do we begin to even think about this? How do we even begin to approach this subject? How do we, as citizens of the kingdom of God, step into a culture, a secular culture like ours, one that celebrates self-worship, broken ideas, anti-God ideas? How do we even begin to think about that? The answer is by ministering to the felt needs of our culture. Listen, we are in the middle of a loneliness epidemic. Despite our phones, despite social media, we are more isolated than ever before, right? Not only that, there's a well-documented rise of depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide, addiction, trauma. All of these things are on the rise, right? The science, the data, they do not lie. We are more broken than ever. You would think that in our culture's do what makes you happy messaging, you would think that we'd be the happiest generation ever, right? But the opposite is actually true. We're actually becoming more and more broken. If you are a disciple of Jesus, then you know that the ultimate answer to all of these things are found in him, in his presence. But people today avoid church, they avoid Christianity. People have a broken idea of what a Christian is. There's a common saying, you know, no one hates like a Christian loves, right? Christians are seen by our culture as judgmental, close-minded, holier than thou. And people are spiritual, but not religious. They don't want to step into church or into church community. If our culture has a false idea of what a Christian is, they definitely have broken ideas about what God is like, if he even exists, right? You and I have a great responsibility to counter those broken ideas by reflecting Jesus and his beauty to them. And we cannot do that if we never interact with them. They're not coming to us. We have to go to them. And we do that by meeting them where they are and ministering to those felt needs, by saying, hey, tell me your story. And really listening, not to counter their lived experience with our opinions or with proof texts, but to empathize with those felt needs, their hurting, loneliness, depression, anxiety, those heart wounds. Jesus commanded us to love radically, church. New commandment I give to you, right? That you love one another the same way that I loved you. You are also to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. So we're not going to surrender our sexuality or anything else until we meet the goodness of God. We are not going to surrender our sexuality until we believe that we can trust God with it. And those that don't know the love and trustworthiness of God will first judge it by how they see it in the lives of those who claim his name. So if we want other people to trust in God, we must be loving, present, patient image bearers. People who make others feel safe enough to ask those big questions. Rooted in Christ enough to be able to lovingly handle disagreement. And by the power of the Holy Spirit, loving enough to leave the door open for continued relationship, no matter the outcome, no matter if somebody's timeline doesn't match our expectations, right? So to summarize, the whole point of outreach to the LGBTQ community or any other essentially non-religious group, it's not to introduce these friends to moral ideology or philosophy. It is to help them see the beauty of Jesus. And we care about bringing people into his presence because it is only there that anybody finds true healing, true rest, and true identity. Thank you for listening. I'm going to hand it over to Wesley. Wes, you learned about mentoring, leadership development. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, that was heavy.
Sorry.
When approached with the opportunity to go to Thrive from Tim and Val, we didn't really know much about it. Didn't really know what to expect. Went to the weekend hoping to learn new ways that would probably help me express my relationship with Christ to others, particularly with like teaching down in early teen. I was also interested in learning about the sides of church that we don't talk about, you know, like what keeps the lights on other than, you know, I know tithe, but like how that works, what goes on in the background. Breakout sessions I attended, like Val said, focused on leadership, mentoring, spiritual formation, and communication. I didn't go into them expecting to be deeply impacted. I really can't say that I was. It was more of a mindset of taking things in and seeing what might be useful that I can bring back and use to help. I didn't end up walking away with several strong takeaways that did challenge how I've thought about leadership with faith, especially when it comes to how we operate here in life at church. One of the most consistent themes I heard was the importance of raising up the next generation of leaders. We talk about mentoring sometimes or bringing younger people along, but these sessions emphasized something more intentional than that. They talked about empowering emerging leaders, not just by giving them advice, but by giving them the actual opportunities to lead. It means listening to their ideas and helping them develop the kinds of skills that we don't teach in school. Things like integrity, adaptability, problem solving, and then stepping aside long enough for them to actually utilize those skills within the church. It's how growth happens. It's not in perfectly packaged programs, but in real life moments where someone is trusted to try. Failure should be celebrated to an extent because it means we actually tried. We gave people the opportunity, and they might have failed at what they were doing, but who's to say that it actually failed? Maybe it was that base stepping stone for someone else as they go on to the next strange. We need to make sure that anyone who shares the gospel within church or out on the street understands that it's Jesus' job to convert, not ours. We're just supposed to tell them about him, share the gospel. Sometimes sharing others with Christ might look like failure, like I said. But it's, like I said, it's not our job. We're good. At our church, I think we've gotten a lot of heart for kids and youth. Grateful for that. But I wonder if there are ways we could take this idea farther. What would it look like if we gave young people real leadership opportunities, not behind the scenes, but up here? Put them up front, let them do things, help them lead prayer time, organize an event for service, sit on ministry planning meetings, so they have the opportunity to learn, but also to contribute, so they actually feel worthwhile and that they can actually help. Sessions I went to reminded me that we're not here to entertain, not just adults, but children, but to show that we believe that they can help out, that we can walk alongside them and help them so they can step into whatever they're called to do. I talk about it with my own kids. My job isn't to help them from making mistakes in life. It's to help them grow and make their own decisions. Well, I can be there to help them with those decisions, the bad or good decisions that are little, so those failures can, with the good consequences or bad, can help them get better. And then when they are out on their own and they make those bigger decisions that can have terrible consequences or great consequences, they're able to deal with that and have the confidence to do it themselves. One of the things that took away from that was we need to do that in church, not just on a family session. Another powerful takeaway that I learned was prayer. One of the speakers said that prayer is honest and not polished. I don't think I'm the only way who has felt pressure to pray the right way, especially in front of other people. What I heard was that prayer isn't about sounding good. It's just about showing up. It's about being there. It's about being real with God, unfiltered, before ourselves, before him. It's not a cleaned up version. It's not knowing the right words, but it's just a version that's tried. It's tired. It's unsure. It's frustrated, but it's also open. It was said like this: prayer's not a place to be good. It's a place to be honest. And that doesn't mean just being honest with God, but honest with ourselves so we can be honest with God. Like, we have to be at that point. And another point was made was that God can hear everything that we say to him because he already knows it. Like, we're not telling him something he doesn't already know. I felt that kind of challenging in my prayer life, and I think it helped. It also made me wonder, do we as a church model that kind of prayer with, you know, that honesty? Do we make space for people to pray messy prayers? You know, or to say, I don't know what to say in prayer, or small groups, or how can we intentionally create environments where people feel safe to be vulnerable, but not just perform spiritual strength? And it's where real transformation within church starts. We can only get better at prayer by actually praying. Another concept that surprised me was this idea that purpose is more important than potential. It reframed helping me realize that potential without purpose is aimless. It's easy to get caught up in chasing skills, opportunities, or even recognition. But when you understand that our God-given purpose, we're no longer operating out of pressure to perform, but we're moving with intention from him. For me, that ties into how we serve in the church. It's not about finding the most talented people and plugging them into spots. It's about helping people discover what they were made for and walking with them, helping them as they grow into that. It might mean we stop asking, what are you good at? Or what am I good at? And start asking, like, what breaks your heart for God? What lights you up? Where do you sense God nudging you, and what are you convicted about? And if you're not convicted, ask yourself, why not? Why aren't we convicted for these things? Helping people uncover that kind of purpose is discipleship, And it's something we can be doing in every ministry and in every age group. The last takeaway I had was about leadership communication. And I'm not someone who likes being up here. never usually the loudest voice. But I was encouraged to hear that charisma isn't what makes a leader effective, but it's having clarity. People don't need hype, but they do need direction. They need to know you believe what they're saying and that you care about them as you say it, and it's what builds trust. As someone who's served in different roles, not necessarily here at church, but work and among other things with lots of different people, prisoners, I've seen how easy it is to think that leadership means being on all the time, being ready to go and everything. But people don't need us to be impressive. They just need us to be present, and they need us to be honest, and they need us to communicate clearly and consistently. In our church, it could mean like making sure we explain why behind decisions that are made. It could look like slowing down enough to check in with volunteers and make sure they feel heard and supported. But all the takeaways pointed me back to same core truth, that leadership is service. It's not about being faithful. I mean, it's not about being most capable or confident, but it is about being faithful. It's about showing up. It's about being honest in prayer, clear in speech, generous with our mentoring, and grounded in a purpose in Jesus. It's not always heroic, and most of the time it probably won't be, but that's okay. I think it's the kind of leadership God honors is usually quiet, steady, and deeply rooted in love. And I'm going to pass along to Macy to talk about all of her experiences.
When I first heard about the leadership conference, I was intrigued, but I've never really thought of myself as a leader. So I wasn't sure what I'd take away from it. Leadership is for pastors and for elders and for adults who are a little bit more adulty than I am, right? But God has other ideas, and he's led me to realize that I do possess leadership visions and ideas, and this conference really put a fire under me. I went to sessions focused on children's ministry, family discipleship, spiritual wellness, and biblical intimacy. I can't cover everything, but I wanted to highlight especially a lot of what I learned about family ministry. One of the biggest takeaways from Thrive is something I think many of us know instinctively. Kids form their faith early. Fourth and fifth grade is a critical window. Kids this age are deeply observant, asking tough questions, and deciding what's real and what's for show. If we wait until they're teenagers to get serious about their spiritual development, we've already missed some of the most important moments. The good news is this kind of discipleship doesn't have to be elaborate or complicated. It starts with a parent, and I heard about some amazing tools designed to help them, like Let's Walk by James Hamilton, a resource that guides intentional conversations at home. But just as important as what happens in families is how the church comes alongside them. We can't just cheer families on from a distance. We need to walk with them, reinforcing what's being built at home, giving kids more than just crafts and snacks, and helping parents feel like church is an extension of their efforts, not a separate thing altogether. As I processed everything from the conference, one question kept coming to mind. Who in our church is looking out for the full picture of family discipleship in our church? We have amazing volunteers and leaders in various areas, in all the Sabbath school classrooms, youth group, women's and men's ministries, but no one is connecting all the dots in between them. It's easy for families to feel like they're constantly switching gears. One area might feel welcoming, another confusing or disconnected. Some kids thrive while their siblings struggle. Some parents feel supported while others quietly drift. Not because anyone is doing anything wrong per se, but because there's no one tasked with stepping back and asking, how do all these pieces work together to serve families best? That's what family ministry leadership can do. Not just running events, but helping new families feel seen and rooted, offering age-scaled but mission-minded programs that make faith feel real and exciting, creating cross-generational opportunities where older kids help the younger ones and adults build trust with kids who aren't necessarily their own, and making sure what happens on Sabbath morning connects meaningfully with what happens at home all week long. Another thread that came up again and again was the power of intergenerational connection. Too often, kids' programming is isolated, one class for this age, another for that, separate from the adults. and mostly designed to keep kids busy. But what if we did more together? What if we reimagined the role of our youth, not just as a group to keep spiritually afloat, but as mentors and leaders for the next generation? Middle and high school students have so much to offer. Energy, creativity, relatability. They don't need to be perfect to be meaningful. Younger kids look up to them, and those connections can be life-changing on both sides. We talk a lot about helping kids turn to God when life is hard, and that's really important. But one session reminded me that we also need to show them how to walk with God when life is good. It's easy to reach for faith when we're desperate, but what about when things are easy? When our prayers feel answered, when life is going smoothly, do we still model devotion, gratitude, and worship? Kids are watching, and they learn not just how to turn to God in crisis, but how to stay with him through contentment. And that kind of steady faith makes a deep impression. Some simple ways to model that include thanking God first thing in the morning, before the phone or the to-do list, keeping family gratitude lists on the fridge, taking a weekly screen-free walk, or letting kids see us say, "I messed up," and then pray and try again. I also heard incredible stories of family-based ministry experiences, elementary-age kids forming their own youth group with worship and learning and service design just for them, older kids helping run Sabbath school once a month, entire families going on mission trips, not just tagging along, but serving with purpose. James Hamilton, the author of Let's Walk, shared how his church took several families on a short-term mission trip through reallife.org. Kids as young as five helped, played, prayed, and served shoulder to shoulder with their parents in other communities. It wasn't overly intense or complicated, just real people doing real ministry together. Another option that aligns more with our Adventist values is Maranatha. They host different types of mission trips all the time, and there are ones available for families once in a while. These are experiences that can plant seeds of faith and purpose in kids while strengthening families and creating lifelong spiritual memories. We always talk about wanting to help families grow closer to God, and this is one of the most hands-on, lasting ways we can do it. I'm really inspired by this idea and would love to see families in this church jump on a family mission opportunity in the future. Underneath all of this is a simple question. Do kids love coming to church? Do they feel safe and noticed and excited to be here? Church should be the place where they feel known, where they have people besides their parents who greet them by name and celebrate who they are and show up consistently, and not just during a Sabbath school hour, but across the whole experience. The same is true for parents. Our families are navigating a lot, busyness and burnout and doubt and distraction. Church should feel like a place of support and refreshment, not like one more stressful obligation. When we invest in making church feel like a home for a whole family, we're building something strong and lasting. On our way home from the conference, we stopped by Doug Batchelor's church and stayed for service and potluck. And not only were we recognized right away as visitors and made to feel welcome, but we were also sought out and brought to the front of the potluck line. It was such a simple thing, but it really made us feel seen and welcome and valued, and that's something really easy that we could implement in our church right away. Okay, now a quick change from the family ministry focus. There was a powerful session on biblical intimacy, sexuality, and healing in marriage. I won't go into it deeply here, but it made me realize how important it is that we don't let culture be the only voice shaping these conversations. Kids and adults alike deserve better than shame or silence. These are conversations that should begin before adulthood. If anyone wants to talk more or explore the resources I learned about, I'd be glad to connect. A couple great resources shared at Thrive were The Talk by Luke Gilkerson. It's a biblical, age-appropriate series for kids and teens. And then The Invisible Bond by Barbara Wilson, which talks about soul ties, sexual brokenness, and healing in marriage. I came home from Thrive hopeful that we can create a culture where faith is more than a lesson, it's a shared life, hopeful that kids will grow up seeing discipleship lived out in joy and consistency, not just in crisis, and hopeful that our church can continue becoming a place where families feel supported, known, and invited to grow together. Okay, switching gears, We started by talking about the general session speakers, and now we want to share what they talked about. We all came together for the general sessions, and each one was an opportunity to examine our personal relationships with God and how that impacts with the way we connect with other people. No matter how you relate to the idea that God has called you to leadership or ministry, we want to encourage you with three perspectives to consider.
First idea was this. Leadership flows from intimacy with God. Before we lead others, before we can inspire others to draw closer to God, we must experience God's love and truth ourselves. Sometimes that can feel like enough of a challenge. The general session asks us to ponder this question: would I describe my relationship with God as personal and intimate? If you're anything like me, finding meaningful connection with God on a daily basis sounds awesome, but putting consistent practices into place that bring us into his presence can be difficult. It can be a journey. I want to encourage us all by acknowledging that no one is perfect, but one of the great things we were reminded of is that God can use our weaknesses for his glory. 2 Corinthians 12:9-10 says, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest in me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties, for when I am weak, then I am strong." When we trust God with our weakness, or the parts of our story that cause us shame, guilt, or pain, he will take those things that Satan meant to destabilize us and redeem them for his glory and our healing.
The second takeaway was this challenge. Life's interruptions can be God's interventions. As parents of young children, this one really hit home for us. We talk about how interruptible Jesus was. We talk about how so many of his miracles were interruptions, and this takeaway kind of challenges to ask, what miracles am I missing out on because I refuse to be interrupted, right? We were encouraged to see interruptions and unexpected turns as part of God's refining process. Now, God does not create chaos or disorder, but he can certainly harness it for our good. C.S. Lewis said, "The best evidence of who we are is how we respond when we are caught off guard." He compared it to rats in a cellar. If you tiptoe down the cellar stairs and then all of a sudden flip on the lights, you will see the rats there. The rats don't just magically appear because of the light. The light just reveals them before they have a chance to hide. And this is the hard truth about sanctification. It is uncomfortable. Growth is not easy. We pray, "God, transform me, grow me," and then we are surprised when he puts us in the middle of an opportunity to be transformed, to lean on him for growth, right? And sometimes it can feel like we're moving backwards. You know, why is that? It's because God is turning the lights on. Interruptions and unexpected challenges help reveal what's always been there. Lewis also said that we begin to be alarmed not only by what we do, but by who we are. But when we allow our perspective to shift and to realize that it is God's mercy and grace and goodness that shows us the truth so that we can come to him, we can see our need and run to him for healing and surrender and allow him to change us, then we slowly, slowly become more interruptible, more able to handle difficulties with grace, mercy, patience, and peace. So here is some homework tied to this takeaway for you this week. Expect to be interrupted. Expect some unforeseen wrench in your plans. And when it comes, and it will, take stock of your reaction. What reactions come to the surface? What emotions? Where is God turning on the lights?
The third takeaway is this, that faithfulness is not holding the fort. Faithfulness is returning an increase. I'm going to beg your forgiveness because we're going to sit on this one for just a few minutes. I know we've been talking a lot, but I think this is super important for us. In Matthew 25, Jesus tells the parable of the talents, right? So there's a master who entrusts each of his servants with money before going on a journey. And one servant was so scared to lose anything that the master had given him that he just buried it in the ground. Just tried to play it safe. Just didn't want to disrupt the status quo. He was scared that the master might get upset if he lost it. And this servant was the one who was called wicked and lazy and lost everything. See, in God's economy, playing it safe is not the goal. Fruitfulness is. Faithfulness isn't passive, it's productive. In that parable, the two servants that invested and provided a return on their investment were called faithful servants. See, too many Christians, we can sometimes think that faithfulness is just about not messing up. But Jesus defines it as bearing fruit. The servant who buried his talent didn't do anything immoral, but he also didn't do anything impactful. That's what made him wicked and lazy. You are entrusted and not excused. Everybody in the parable got something. No one is talentless. No one is exempt from this principle. I only got one is not an excuse. God's question isn't how much did you have, but what did you do with what I gave you? And you and I may not be accountable for what somebody else has, but we are absolutely accountable for what we have been given. Now, here's the good news of the gospel is that you don't do that multiplication, that bearing of fruit on your own power. You do that only through the power of the Holy Spirit who is given to you, but you do have to engage. The greatest risk is playing it safe. The third servant's fear is what kept him from actual obedience to the master. And maybe we can be guilty of this. We can confuse waiting on God with just avoiding responsibility ourselves. Sometimes playing it safe might feel spiritual, but if we're honest, maybe it's self-protection and not stewardship. God is not calling you and I to be careful with our calling. He's calling us to be courageous Amen. With our calling. And the master is returning, and he's expecting a harvest. We are stewards of grace, of gifts, of the influence that you have and you have been given, and of time. We all have that in the same amount. And there will be, as this story points out, an accounting. And this is not about fear, but about honor. About offering our lives, as Romans 12 said, as a living sacrifice, as evidence of our love for Jesus and because of what he's done. This will happen if we allow and surrender our lives to God, intimacy with God. This will naturally happen, but we have to engage. When Jesus returns, he's not looking for what you buried. He's looking for what you built. And in the upside-down kingdom of God, what you built is almost never actually about you. It's about somebody else. Faithfulness is not holding the fort. Faithfulness is returning and increase. We are not called as followers of Jesus to just hold the fort, to create our safe place and protect it and avoid risk and discomfort. We are not just called to protect what God has given us and try not to lose it. We're not called to just keep Adventists. We are called to expand the kingdom of heaven here on earth. And maybe you've thought, because I've thought it, faithfulness is just not quitting, just not walking away. But what if today Jesus is calling you to more than just survival? What if faithfulness means fruitfulness? What if the Lord wants to say over your life, well done, good and faithful servant, because you didn't just keep the faith, you grew it. If you've been listening and something that we've shared has struck a chord with you, or if you're feeling inspired to grow in ministry, we want to leave you with this. Great ministry, which we are all called to, flows from authentic relationship with Jesus. Number one, non-negotiable. If you want to see the lives of the people that you know transformed and healed, the best thing you can do is to spend daily time in the presence of the one who transforms and heals. And great ministry also means intentional investment in others. Investment of your time, of your talents, the resources that you've been gifted. Each one here has something to invest in another person. Ask God to show you who in your sphere of influence needs someone to come alongside them and how God would have you show up for that person. And if you want more information about anything that we talked about today, find one of us, shoot us a text. We'd love to connect and share more about the resources and the learning.
Four of us are so grateful for the intentional investment by our church family for allowing us to represent our church at Thrive, having us come share with you what we learned. We each came home with unique insights to share and hopefully implement, insights that will shape our preaching, discipleship, leadership, family ministries for the coming season. In closing, let's come to God again in prayer and thank him for our plans for church and for all of us.
Yeah, let's stand together and thank him. Father, who are we? Who are we that you would just so lovingly and patiently want to reconcile us to yourself, God? Who are we that you want to partner with us in the beautiful mission of declaring your rule and reign to the world? God, thank you for resources like Thrive Conference. Thank you for events like Camp Meeting happening now that empower us and give us vision, that give us practical tools to meet people where they are and to bring them into the fold. God, thank you that every single person in this room and watching online has a place, not just at your table, God, but in your fields, helping to bring the harvest in. God, light a fire under this church. Light a fire in our hearts for your mission, for our individual callings, God. Make us bold. Make us brave. Help us to leap into your arms unafraid with the mission and the calling that you so lovingly place on the hearts of each one here. As we go, may we find true Sabbath rest today, resting with joy in your vision, in your power, in your love. We love you.